Reading from Srimad Bhavam, Canto 3, Chapter 7, Verse 29. Varnashram vivagamscha Urupasila svabhavatah Rishinam janma karmani Vedasya cha vikarshanam. Varnashrama. Four divisions of social statuses and orders of spiritual culture. Vibhagan. Respective divisions. Cha. Also. Rupa. Personal features. Sila svabhavata. Personal character. Rishinam. Of the sages. Janma. Birth. Karmani, activities, Vedasya, of the Vedas, cha, and Vikarshanam, categorical divisions. Translation, O great sage, kindly describe the divisions and orders of human society in terms of symptoms, behavior, and characteristics of mental equilibrium and sense control. Also, please describe the births of the great sages and the categorical divisions of the Vedas. Purport, the four statuses and orders of human society, Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Sudras, as well as Brahmacharis, Grihasthas, Vanaprasthas, and Sannyasis, are all divisions of quality, education, culture, and spiritual advancement attained by practicing control of the mind and senses. All these divisions are based on the particular nature of each individual person, not on the principle of birth. Birth is not mentioned in this verse because birth is immaterial. Vidura is famous in history as born of a Sudrani mother, yet he is more than a Brahmana by qualification because he is seen here to be the disciple of the great sage Maitreya Muni. Unless one achieves at least Brahminical qualifications, one cannot understand the Vedic hymns. Mahabharata is also a division of the Vedas, but it is meant for women, sudras, and dvijabandhus, the worthless children of the higher section. The less intelligent section of society can avail themselves of the Vedic instructions simply by studying the Mahabharata. Translation, O great sage, kindly describe the divisions and orders of human society in terms of symptoms, behavior, and characteristics of mental equilibrium and sense control. And please describe the birth of the great sage and categorical divisions of the Vedas. So here is a further request by Vidura to Maitreya to describe some other topics. And here the topic is Varnashram system and birth of the great sages and divisions of the Vedas, which are discussed in the Bhagavatam, as well as other Puranas and Smriti Shastras. So, there's always a little controversy about the status of Varnashrama. In one sense, if we look at the descriptions given in the Nectar Devotion, Varnashrama is considered to be inferior to the process of Bhakti, and therefore it is not called an Anga of Bhakti at all. It is quite distinct, since its goals are artha, dharma, and kama. And then when we get to jnana yoga, the goal is moksha. So karma yoga and jnana yoga constitute artha, dharma, kama, and moksha. And of course, artha, dharma, kama, they keep us in the material world, and moksha gives us impersonal liberation. So all of these are ultimately unfavorable for bhakti, so they don't cause bhakti. Certainly, in certain cases, they're unfavorable. Nevertheless, certain elements of these angas can also be cultivated with bhakti. And therefore, in the definition of bhakti given in the Nectar Devotion, the particular phrase uses jnana karma janavratam. The cultivation of a relationship to Krishna favorably should not be obstructed by portions of jnana, karma, etc. But it does not say sunya. Someone theoretically can practice karma yoga, which means varnashram, or elements of jnana, as long as they do not impede or contradict or are unfavorable to the process of bhakti. So in other words, certain elements of jnana are unfavorable. For instance, if we make the goal impersonal, merging in Brahman instead of serving the Lord eternally, then it's obviously unfavorable. That aspect of jnana we must reject. Some aspects of jnana may be favorable, such as taking sannyas or controlling the senses. Or seeing everything equally. So these aspects of jnana could be favorable. And similarly, varnashram system. Unfavorable elements would be worshipping devatas, having one's sole goal, making a living and enjoying in the material world, or going to Svargaloka by doing punya activities. This unfavorable, obviously, because it gives us further material attachment. So what could we find favorable in the karma yoga system? Again, dharma, following principles of sense control, obviously favorable for bhakti. In themselves, they don't create bhakti, but they're favorable for devotional development. And therefore, we have vows like following four regulator principles, which basically comes from dharma. Four pillars of dharma are there, supported by certain principles. And these are favorable for the devotional development. So therefore, we can say, in that sense, parts of the varnashram are favorable, parts are unfavorable. Parts of jnana are favorable, parts of jnana unfavorable. So we have to reject the unfavorable elements. So particularly the goals of these systems we must reject, because the goals are implicitly contrary. The goal of jnana is merging in Brahman. The goal of karma yoga is stay in the material world and enjoy. So then we have to reject that. Then if we do reject those elements, then we can still practice pure bhakti, even though we incorporate elements of varnashram or jnana, etc., into our system. There's not a problem, as long as there's no obstruction. So, therefore, pure bhakti can be practiced along with these elements. At the same time, we should never confuse the two and say that varnashram is equal to bhakti or karma yoga is bhakti, etc. Otherwise, the terminologies would not be used to distinguish them in the first place. It would all be called bhakti yoga. But we do have karma yoga with varnashram, and we have jnana yoga, and we have bhakti yoga, distinct systems. Because generally the goals are very distinct. And therefore the processes leading to those goals are distinct. So if the goal of karma yoga is go to Svargaloka, obviously that practice in itself cannot give you bhakti and help promote you to prema. It doesn't do that. And the same with jnana. Jnana gives you liberation and impersonal Brahman. That can also not give you prema. So there is some distinction in the goals, the processes, and the processes themselves. And therefore we give different labels to them. So the particular request here is to describe that varnashram system. We will see several places in the Bhagavatam. For instance, in the third canto in Kapila's teachings, he deals with varnashram system. In the seventh canto, Prahlad also deals with that system. And in the 11th canto, Krishna, in speaking to Uddhava, also describes that system. So we find some, in some places, quite detailed descriptions of the duties of the different varnas and ashramas. And if we look at these duties, we'll find that a lot of it we don't even want to do in bhakti. We look at the rules for the householder who goes around scrounging for grains in the marketplace, and the grains that fall down, then he takes those and goes home and he cooks those grains and offers those grains, and that's what he survives on his whole life. Him and his family, they survive on grains that fall in the marketplace. So after everybody's taken out of all the grains away and there's only the garbage left, then he takes that. So that's a type of grihasta, one of the types of grihasta, which is very impractical for us to follow in the modern world. But that's his varna, so to speak, as a brahmana, to survive off the grains that fall in the marketplace. And another one goes into the fields after they've harvested all the crops, and he takes all the extra grains that nobody picked up, and he lives off those.
So that is another type of brahmana, you know, for instance. So very difficult for us to practically follow in the present society. And if we look at the ashramas, again, quite strict in their rules. The brahmacharya ashram is very strict. You can't wear shoes. You can't do this. You can't do that. You can't eat at certain times. Many, many rules. And, of course, the grihasas and vanaprasas and sannyasi is very, very strict. And a lot of we'll find the tendency in the renunciation is toward a little bit towards impersonal vairagya instead of towards bhakti. So then why actually even encourage the discussion of the varna ashram system? And the reason is that we see that one of the topics of the Bhagavatam is the manvantaras, the ruling periods of manus. And manus are the kings who established the varna ashram system for 71 yuga cycles. Of course, it's sometimes strong and sometimes weak. In Kali Yuga, it is weak, and in other yugas, it is stronger. Nevertheless, the manus and his descendants are there to support this system of dharma and varnashram for the people in general. So the manus are actually empowered. They are they're not Shaktivesh avatars, but they are empowered by the Supreme Lord to carry out his will of establishing this varnashram system. So they are called vibhutis of the Lord. In the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, it's called sometimes vibhuti yoga. So vibhuti means particular aspects of the material world which show the power of the Lord. So in terms of empowerment, it means certain living entities are empowered by the Lord to do his purposes, but they're not given that position eternally, temporarily. So therefore the devatas, the great sages, and the manus are included in this category of vibhuti. And the particular power given to the sages is distribute Vedic knowledge. The power given to the devatas is enforce the laws of karma and distribute the necessities to the living entities on earth planet. And the power given to the manus is institute the system of dharma and varnashram for the general public. So that is one of the topics of the Bhagavatam, to how the description of the manus and how they institute dharma. So this is this whole karma yoga system and varnashram is a system for the people in general, not for the devotees particularly. That means that some people are qualified for bhakti and some are not. If they're not qualified for bhakti, at least they should do varnashram. If they don't need to do varnashram, then they're considered hopeless. This is uncivilized people, the chandalas and the mlechas and others. So the first step in civilization is, or the human being is, follow this varnashram system. If they develop shraddha, or faith, conviction in the supremacy of the one supreme Lord, and that we are the servant of that Lord, they are qualified for bhakti. So that's a higher qualification. General qualification of people is they simply want to survive in the material world. They want to get enough food for themselves and their family. People that are only interested in that, let them follow varnashram system. But this is considered superior to people who don't follow the system because there are specific rules to elevate you. Whereas in a non-varnashramic society with its rules and regulations, there is no real system for elevation as such. There's only provision for feeding you, that's all. So the basic financial, economic thing is taken care of, or they attempt to do so, but there's no goal of elevation because there's no concept of gunas even in these societies. But the scriptures point out we have tamogun, rajagun, sattvagun. So the goal is to raise a person from the lower guna to the higher guna. That's the goal in the varnashram system. from tamoguna to sattvaguna. And therefore we have classes based on gunas. We have sudras and tamagun, we have vaishyas and tamagun, rajagun, we have kshatriyas in rajagun, sattvagun, and we have brahmanas in sattvagun. So the whole purpose is elevation by restriction. Following certain rules and regulations help us elevate ourselves. So we start at the bottom. Minimum of rules and regulations, but something is there. That's for the sudras. By following those rules and regulations, gradually they elevate themselves into rajagun. Then they become vaishyas. They're given a little more freedom. More rules to follow, though. Elevate themselves to rajagun, sattvagun, kshatriyas. Kshatriyas follow those rules properly. Gradually they elevate themselves after many, many births into brahminical status, sattvagun. So that's the whole idea of the varnashram system. Once one gets to sattvagun and one becomes very brahminical, one becomes qualified for jnana yoga and moksha. So in this system, therefore, artha, dharma, kama, and moksha are the goals. Moksha for jnana and artha, dharma, kama for the people in the sattvagun, rajagun, and tamagun. That's the limit of varnashram as such. And therefore, it is rejected as the system for the devotee. The devotee's goal is not artha, dharma, kama, moksha, but prema. Therefore, he has to follow a different system. So that is bhakti yoga. What's the difference? Bhakti yoga is not concerned with maintaining your material body, artha. It is not concerned with getting material enjoyment, kama. It is not concerned with the rules for getting these, dharma. Nor is it concerned with getting impersonal liberation or moksha. So the means of getting to prema is simply activities like hearing, chanting, remembering, sadhu sangha, deity worship, etc. This is what we call bhakti. Now, the varnashram system may incorporate parts of bhakti, just as in bhakti, we can incorporate parts of varnashram, which are non-contrary. In the varnashram system, we can also put parts of bhakti. So we'll see. In the varnashram system, there's also worship of the Supreme Lord Vishnu or Krishna, along with worship of devatas, etc. There may be kirtan and so many other forms of worship also. Why we don't call it bhakti? We can call it bhakti, but it is bhakti maybe 1% or 2%. And its goal is quite different. Therefore, we don't call it bhakti, we call it varnashram. And in fact, that varnashram system does not really get its success in terms of peaceful maintenance of your material existence and elevation to svarga loka unless there is worship of the Supreme Lord in it. So some bhakti has to be there. In other words, it's not an independent system. It is dependent on bhakti. And even jnana, to get liberation, one has to also worship the Supreme Lord. So the goal of jnana, which is liberation, is also dependent on bhakti. So these systems are not really independent, though they look independent. And they have prominence of other things. They must have worship of the Lord somewhere in them. But we do not call them bhakti because majority of the system is something else and the goal is something else. Bhakti, on the other hand, does not depend on anything else to get its goal, prema. Varnashram cannot give prema. Jnana cannot give prema. Ashtanga yoga cannot give prema. Only bhakti can give prema. And whether we combine bhakti with jnana or karma or not, it gives the same result. It doesn't mean that it is better if we do bhakti and then we also do the varnashram system. Does it make it better? No. It may be favorable, but ultimately not necessary. So the only necessity to get prema is to do bhakti. Then, optionally, we may do parts of varnashram or parts of jnana, etc., as is favorable to us. Of course, we always find that the more a person advances, the less interested he is in anything else except bhakti. And therefore we find a person like Madhavendra Puri that says, goodbye my tarpanas and goodbye my sanjha vandana. These are all parts of Varnashram system. Goodbye all of this, goodbye all of that. I simply meditate on the Supreme Lord. That's all. So the more one becomes attracted to the Lord, the less interested one is in following these other duties. We see, though, very interestingly, that generally acharyas do not explicitly reject the conduct of the Varnashram system. So Lord Chaitanya himself followed the Varnas and the Ashramas. He conducted himself like a Brahma in general and as a sannyasi in general. Again, we saw he kind of contradicted it also in certain places. He took his food from low-class people who were Vaishnavas rather than from Brahmanas who were not Vaishnavas, for instance. So that's why he contradicted the social system at the time. But in general, he followed some aspects of the Varnashram, in spite of the fact that in so many places in Chaitanya Charitamrita, he condemns the Varnashram system as useless and external, etc. Yet he still followed it. And we find acharyas like Vishwanath Chakravarti, who came from Brahminical, by birth families, they generally followed the system. They didn't break the system. And therefore, it is not that the system of bhakti is deliberately trying to reject or disturb the social system. But at the same time, it is pointing out the superiority and independence of bhakti over everything else, and therefore everything else gets condemned in the process. That's why we find these condemnations of Varnashram and Jnana, etc., to show the superiority and independence of bhakti, and that it is quite different from any other system. So therefore, the question will then arise, well, even if Lord Chaitanya didn't reject the Varnashram system in terms of his conduct, how should the devotees act in the modern age? Definitely in other ages, yes, they would follow to some degree. So our acharyas did follow, like Valadeva Jibhusan and Vishwanath Chakravarti followed. Others did not follow because they weren't in the system. Rupa and Sanatan were out of the system. They were rejected. Though they came from Brahminical families, originally from South India, they had associated with the Muslim government, and therefore they were rejected, so they couldn't even follow anything as far as Varnashram is concerned. For that reason, they never even bothered to go in the Jagannath temple or try to go in the Jagannath temple because they were completely rejected as outcasts. So they also respected that system. They didn't challenge that social system at the time, in spite of the fact they're transcendental and they're highly qualified. So some of them were outside the system, some were in the system. Haridas Thakur was outside the system also. He was completely beyond the whole system. And he never challenged it also. Others follow the system, and we'll see they respected, they didn't disturb the social system. And they followed certain rules and regulations, as if they were Brahmins, they would follow the Brahminical rules, etc., not just reject everything. So that carried on. But now we have the modern world where nobody really understands the system at all, really. And therefore, what is the respect for that system in the modern world? Even the Brahmanas tend not to follow much at all in the modern world, what to speak of other people in India. They're not even familiar with the rules and regulations of the Varnashram system anymore. The only remnants are attachment to worshipping devatas, which their families did for generations, which we're not interested in, or following samskaras. So they get a marriage, they have a marriage samskara, which is following the Varnashram system. So that's almost a minimum that people follow. Other than that, very few rules and regulations are followed by top to bottom, whether that's Sudra, Vaishya, Kshatriya, or Brahmana. Very few people follow in the modern world. The only place they would follow probably is in the temples in South India, for instance. The pujaris will follow because they're Brahmins. And in villages, they will follow to some degree some things. Other than that, very little is followed in the modern world. So then, what is the devotee approach to the Varnashram system? Do we follow or not? So in one sense, it's
not very practical because most people struggle just to do the bhakti part. What does it speak of doing anything else? Just to come up with the standard of bhakti, they're struggling to do that. So how can they follow a whole other system of rules, which is actually foreign to them now because they don't even know anything about it? And especially if you're a foreigner. You're not even born in India, then it is very foreign. So to how much is it relevant? So that's the question we do have to ask. The main reason we do ask the question is because Prabhupada says he emphasizes in some places the Varnashram system and that we should follow Varnashram and that half my work is done, follow Varnashram. So then we get a little stuck on how to institute the Varnashram, which we can't even follow. And it's more difficult than following bhakti even. So that becomes a problem, how to do that. So maybe the solution is simply that we take what is favorable in the Varnashram system that supports bhakti. In other words, we struggle to do bhakti, but maybe some things from the Varnashram will also help us to perform our bhakti properly. So those elements of regulations and purity and everything else that can help us execute hearing, chanting, remembering, and deity worship properly, yes, we can follow those to some extent, though not perfectly. So, of course, this is a far cry from varnas and ashramas, but it's taking some of the general rules that everybody in the varnashram system would follow and applying that to our code of conduct in terms of cleanliness, social interaction, etc., family, raising families, etc. So to that extent, good, because the system of bhakti doesn't cover all the details of how to raise a family or how to interact with other people in society or how to keep your body clean or how to keep healthy or dietary regulations, etc. So that's found in other things like Ayurveda and the Varnashram system, etc. So in that sense, we can follow aspects of Varnashram. Bhaktivinoda Thakur calls such rules that we borrow from the Varnashram to be secondary rules of bhakti. And the primary rules are things, activities which directly increase the bhakti, such as hearing, chanting, remembering, deity worship. We have 64 angas in the nectar devotion. These directly produce or manifest and increase bhakti until we get prema. On the other hand, washing your body or brushing your teeth or dressing in clean clothes does not produce bhakti as such. Even people in the material world do these things, but they are regulated in a certain way in the Varnashram system, how to bathe, how to brush your teeth, how to put your clothes on, and everything. Some regulation is there. And this is favorable for our health and for cleanliness is favorable to bhakti also. So therefore, they can be incorporated, but they don't produce bhakti. So we just realize that they are a different type of rule and regulation, that's all. And we borrow from the Varnashram system for those rules and regulations. Bhakti doesn't deal with how to support your body and all of this. So we take the favorable rules, which are non-contrary to bhakti, from that system and incorporate them in their life. Why? Because we are living in a society. If we do not live in a society and we're all off by ourselves alone somewhere, it doesn't matter. We don't have to follow. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to interact with people. You don't have to have a family. You don't even have to keep clean. You can just sit in a cave all the time and chant Hare Krishna. And you can get perfection that way. But most people can't do that. They're living in a society with other people, with devotees and with family members, and they're maybe working at a job in the society, etc. So there has to be some interaction somewhere for most people, and therefore let us follow these rules as much as possible, rules of the Varnashram system, where applicable to the individual. To that extent, we can follow what is favorable for our devotional development. Okay.
Mm.
mix into bhakti yoga.
There's maybe two reasons for this. One, of course, is because there is an element of bhakti in karma yoga. That's the good element, but it's a minor element. So to distinguish them, then we have bhakti, which is only bhakti without any mixture at all. And then we have the karma yoga, which has some bhakti in it, but which is majority something else. And therefore, we'll find in the karma yoga section in chapter 3, Krishna says, worship the devatas, and they give you all your desired results, and follow your duties, and do this and that, and be happy in this lifetime. So obviously, it's not actually bhakti as we know it. But because there is an element in bhakti also, we can say it like that. The other thing is that there's a way of interpretation, that's Baladeva Vidyabhusan's interpretation of karma yoga. He says, these are the activities described for a certain type of devotee who follows the Varnashram system, but is also doing bhakti. So he is doing the karma yoga as if it is part of his bhakti. He's not the supreme type of devotee, but he's a type of devotee. So he classifies devotees of three types. The first is one who is slightly attached to those Varnashram rules and follows everything very nicely, as if he's a karma yogi, but he's actually a devotee. He worships the Lord, etc. He has a slight attachment to following those rules and regulations. He's the lower level. Higher than that is another person who's doing the same devotional activities. He also follows the rules and regulations, but with no attachment. And the only reason he's doing them is to set an example for others. That's all. Huh? But he's still doing all the activities of Varnashram. So he's also a devotee, but he's still doing those rules also, as long as they're not contrary to bhakti. The third type of devotee is one who has no interest in doing them at all. He is simply attached to the Supreme Lord, and he rejects everything. He doesn't follow any rules at all. He just does bhakti, finished. So the last two are basically the same, except one is following simply because he wants to set an example for others. So we find the example of the kings like Dhruva or Ambarish or Prahlad, etc. They actually don't have any attachment to those rules at all. They just want to do bhakti. But they set an example as leaders of society, as kings for other people. And other people may be a little more attached to those rules and regulations they follow. So they're doing the karma yoga and they're doing the bhakti. So in one sense, we can say everything is bhakti because they're devotees. So everything is bhakti. But those karma yoga rules are maybe like we call secondary rules. And Bhakti Sandarbha, Jiva Goswami says, such things as karma yoga, when they are simultaneously done with bhakti, can be called sangha siddha bhakti. They become bhakti by association with bhakti, even though technically they're not bhakti by their very nature. But when they're combined with the bhakti and they help out the bhakti, okay, we can call it part of bhakti also. So in that sense, karma yoga can become bhakti also, where it's used to support the bhakti. Or where it's done independently, and then it's considered useless completely. And if you reject the worship of the Lord completely, it's also considered useless.
You were mentioning that cleanliness, etc., these are secondary activities, not primary activities. So if Prabhupada, you know, mentioned somewhere, cleanliness is godliness.
So obviously, atheists also bathe. Impersonalists also bathe, and they maybe follow the Vedic rituals for bathing, etc., especially the Mayavadis, but they never get bhakti because they bathe. Even being a vegetarian does not necessarily make you into a devotee. And so all the impersonalists are also generally, Shankarites, etc., are vegetarian, but simply not eating meat does not make you produce bhakti either. What they do is they purify you to a certain extent and put you up to sattva gun. But they don't in any way cause bhakti or create bhakti or manifest bhakti or make bhakti grow as such. But along with bhakti, they can be favorable for us. So in that sense, cleanliness is also one of those things which is sattvic by nature and therefore favorable for our devotional development. But it's also distinct from bhakti itself and so on. Yeah, that's the sattvic aspect of karma yoga. When we
or in Raja and Tamagun generally, it's Sakama Karma Yoga. And when we get to, let's say, the top of Rajaguna, and we get into stuff, but then it becomes Nishkama Karma Yoga.
No.
The in itself, Nishkama Karma Yoga cannot give liberation because we do need the cultivation of the understanding we're not the body, we are the Atma, everything like that, which is part of Jnana Yoga. So therefore, the Nishkama Karma Yoga generally combines with the Jnana Yoga, and then we can get our liberation. The two are, we can say, compatible. Obviously, Sakama Karma Yoga and Jnana cannot go along because qualification for Jnana Yoga is Sattva. And Sakama Karma Yoga is in Rajagun, Tamagun. So that doesn't work at all. So when we come to Nishkama Karma Yoga, then that is quite the one that leads into Jnana Yoga quite conveniently. And the two can be practiced simultaneously. It would have to be some mixture, yeah. I think in the, is it the teachings of Kapila? There he mentions the different goals you get from the different processes, etc. Generally, karma yoga can lead you upwards, and probably you can go to Brahmaloka or something ultimately with Nishkama Karma Yoga. And that to get out of the material world, you have to do something, mix it with the Jnana, at least. Pure devotional service? No. Pure devotional service is beyond the mode of goodness. It is visuddha sattva. If we get stuck in sattva gun, that will lead us to liberation. Jnana is in sattva gun. That will lead to liberation, but not to bhakti. So bhakti goes beyond the gunas. It is nirguna. Its nature is nirguna. It is beyond the gunas. Visuddha sattva. I've never seen a comment like that. It's possible. Definitely his status was actually not, we can say, as advanced as Vidura, because Vidura was actually an associate of the Lord. So he was a very high status. But in spite of that fact, Vidura was taking instructions from Maitreya. What's that? Yeah. Their descendants also.
So
one of the we see in the Bhagavatam, it traces the lineage from Swayambhuva, Himanu, Priyavrata, Dhruva, all these kings, and then when we get to the ninth canto, it traces them all the way up to Krishna. There are different descendants from Manu going all in the sub-branches and everything, and then we get up to Krishna, and then after that, there's a whole discussion of how the branches die out, etc., and then the demons take control, and they assassinate somebody, and the dynasties are completely useless in Kali Yuga because there's no descendant of Manu left, and the only one left is hiding in the Himalayas someplace, and he won't manifest himself until the next Satya Yuga. So therefore, it's real hopeless in Kali Yuga. Yeah, well, that's the question I was posing here, to what extent we can do it. And it looks as if we can do very little as far as the Varnashram proper, Because as Prabhupada mentions in the purport, right out we reject the varna by birth. And a lot of the system as we know it is based upon the birth. For instance, the family system, the occupation, everything is based upon that. In other words, you're born in a family, a goldsmith, you become a goldsmith. And so there's no question of going to university or whatever like this. You just get trained up by your parents. If you're a potter's family, you become a potter, and you don't go to college to learn pottery. You learn from your parents. So there, you don't have to go to all these different endeavors to find out who you are and what you're going to do. It's just a taken for granted by your birth of what you're going to be. So that's by birth. So if we don't do by birth, then we do have a big problem. And it introduces a whole other system of education, etc., because everybody has to figure out what varna they're in and whatever after they're grown up. And so it's quite different system from what we see as the normal system in the varnashram when we introduce the not by birth. But so then what do? And then we have to make some endeavor to establish a whole educational system and a whole judging system for people, etc., which is very complicated, you know, which probably people won't even want to do anyway. So these are some of the problems that come up in the institute. The other is we don't even have a system with a king anymore because the Manu's descendant is hiding in the Himalayas. So how do we institute such a system as such, you know? It's impossible also. Because without that authority of the king, again, it doesn't work. And how we do it in the modern world where we have democracy, unless you create a revolution and overthrow all the governments, you know? And so there's a lot of problems in instituting Varnashram as such. So my solution is that we just take some aspects of the Varnashram that are favorable for bhakti and we try to implement those, that's all. They may be minor things, but that's all we can do at the present time. Okay. Hare Krishna.
Srimad Bhagavatam Canto 3, Chapter 7, Verse 29. Varnashram vibhagamscha rupasila svabhavatah rishinam janma karmani vedasya cha vikarshanam. Varnashrama. Four divisions of social statuses and orders of spiritual culture. Vibhagam. Respective divisions. Sha. Also. Rupa. Personal features. Sila Svabhavata. Personal character. Rishinam. Of the sages. Janma. Birth. Karmani, activities, Vedasya, of the Vedas, cha, and Vikarshanam, categorical divisions. Translation, O great sage, kindly describe the divisions and orders of human society in terms of symptoms, behavior, and characteristics of mental equilibrium and sense control. Also, please describe the births of the great sages and the categorical divisions of Vedas. Purport, the four statuses and orders of human society, Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Sudras, as well as Brahmacharis, Grihasthas, Vanaprasthas, and Sannyasis, are all divisions of quality, education, culture, and spiritual advancement attained by practicing control of the mind and the senses. All these divisions are based on the particular nature of each individual person, not on the principle of birth. Birth is not mentioned in this verse because birth is immaterial. Vidura is famous in history as born of a Sudrani mother, yet he is more than a Brahmana by qualification because he is seen here to be the disciple of the great sage Maitreya Muni. Unless one achieves at least Brahminical qualifications, one cannot understand the Vedic hymns. Mahabharata is also a division of the Vedas, but it's meant for women, sudras, and dvijabandhus, the worthless children of the higher section. The less intelligent section of society can avail themselves of the Vedic instructions simply by studying the Mahabharata.
Translation, O great sage, kindly describe the divisions and orders of human society in terms of symptoms, behavior, and characteristics of mental equilibrium and sense control. And please describe the birth of the great sage and categorical divisions of the Vedas. So here is a further request by Vidura to Maitreya to describe some other topics. Here the topic is Varnashram system and birth of the great sages and divisions of the Vedas, which are discussed in the Bhagavatam as well as other Puranas and Smriti Shastras. So, there's always a little controversy about the status of Varnashrama. In one sense, if we look at the descriptions given in the Nectar Devotion, Varnashrama is considered to be inferior to the process of bhakti. And therefore it is not called an Anga of bhakti at all. It is quite distinct, since its goals are artha, dharma, and kama. And then when we get to jnana yoga, the goal is moksha. So karma yoga and jnana yoga constitute artha, dharma, kama, and moksha. And of course, artha, dharma, kama, they keep us in the material world, and moksha gives impersonal liberation. So all of these are ultimately unfavorable for bhakti, so they don't cause bhakti. Certainly, in certain cases, they're unfavorable. Nevertheless, certain elements of these angas can also be cultivated with bhakti. And therefore, in the definition of bhakti given in the Nectar Devotion, the particular phrase used is jnana karma jnavratam. The cultivation of a relationship to Krishna favorably should not be obstructed by portions of jnana, karma, etc. But it does not say sunyan. So one theoretically can practice karma yoga, which means varnashram, or elements of jnana, as long as they do not impede or contradict or are unfavorable to the process of bhakti. So in other words, certain elements of jnana are unfavorable. For instance, if we make the goal impersonal, merging in Brahman instead of serving the Lord eternally, then it's obviously unfavorable. That aspect of jnana we must reject. Some aspects of jnana may be favorable, such as taking sannyas or controlling the senses. Or seeing everything equally. So these aspects of jnana could be favorable. And similarly, Varnashram system, unfavorable elements would be worshipping devatas, having one's sole goal, making a living and enjoying in the material world, or going to Svargaloka by doing punya activities. This unfavorable, obviously, because it gives us further material attachment. So what could we find favorable in the karma yoga system? Again, dharma, following principles of sense control, obviously favorable for bhakti. In themselves, they don't create bhakti, but they're favorable for devotional development. Therefore, we have vows like following four regulator principles, which basically comes from dharma. Four pillars of dharma are there, supported by certain principles. And these are favorable for the devotional development. So therefore, we say, in that sense, parts of the Varnashram are favorable, parts are unfavorable. Parts of jnana are favorable, parts of jnana unfavorable. So we have to reject the unfavorable elements. So particularly the goals of these systems we must reject, because the goals are implicitly contrary. The goal of jnana is merging in Brahman. The goal of karma yoga is stay in the material world and enjoy. So then we have to reject that. Then, if we do reject those elements, then we can still practice pure bhakti, even though we incorporate elements of varnashram or jnana, etc., into our system. There's not a problem, as long as there's no obstruction. So, therefore, pure bhakti can be practiced along with these elements. At the same time, we should never confuse the two and say that varnashram is equal to bhakti, or karma yoga is bhakti, etc.
Otherwise, the terminologies would not be used to distinguish them in the first place. It would all be called bhakti yoga. But we do have karma yoga with varnashram, and we have jnana yoga, and we have bhakti yoga, distinct systems. Because generally the goals are very distinct. And therefore the processes leading to those goals are distinct. So if the goal of karma yoga is a goal to svarga loka, obviously that practice in itself cannot give you bhakti and help promote you to prema. It doesn't do that. And the same with jnana. Jnana gives you liberation and impersonal Brahman. That can also not give you prema. So there is some distinction in the goals, the processes, and the processes themselves. And therefore we give different labels to them. So the particular request here is to describe that varnashram system. We will see several places in the Bhagavatam, for instance in the third canto in Kapila's teachings, he deals with varnashram system. In the seventh canto, Prahlad also deals with that system. And in the 11th canto, Krishna, in speaking to Uddhava, also describes that system. So we find some, in some places, quite detailed descriptions of the duties of the different varnas and ashramas. And if we look at these duties, we'll find out a lot of it we don't even want to do in bhakti. We look at the rules for the householder who goes around scrounging for grains in the marketplace, and the grains that fall down, then he takes those and goes home and he cooks those grains and offers those grains, and that's what he survives on his whole life. Him and his family, they survive on grains that fall in the marketplace. So after everybody's taken out of all the grains away and there's only the garbage left, then he takes that. So that's a type of grihasta, one of the types of grihasta, which is very impractical for us to follow in the modern world. But that's his varna, so to speak. There's a brahmana to survive off the grains that fall in the marketplace. And another one goes into the fields after they've harvested all the crops, and he takes all the extra grains that nobody picked up, and he lives off those. So that is another type of brahmana, for instance. So very difficult for us to practically follow in the present society. And if we look at the ashramas again, quite strict in their rules. The brahmacharya ashram is very strict. You can't wear shoes, you can't do this, you can't do that. You can't eat at certain times, many rules. And of course the grihasas and vana process and sannyasi is very, very strict. And a lot of we'll find the tendency in the renunciation is for a little bit towards impersonal vairagya instead of towards bhakti. So, then, why actually even encourage the discussion of the varnashram system? And the reason is that we see that one of the topics of the Bhagavatam is the manvantaras, the rules, the ruling periods of manus. And manus are the kings who established the varnashram system for 71 yuga cycles. Of course, it's sometimes strong and sometimes weak. In Kali Yuga, it is weak, and in other yugas, it is stronger. Nevertheless, the manus and his descendants are there to support this system of dharma, varnashram, for the people in general. So the manus are actually empowered. They're not Shaktivesh avatars, but they are empowered by the Supreme Lord to carry out his will of establishing this varnashram system. So they are called vibhutis of the Lord. In the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, it's called sometimes vibhuti yoga. So vibhuti means particular aspects of the material world which show the power of the Lord. So in terms of empowerment, it means certain living entities are empowered by the Lord to do his purposes, but they're not given that position eternally, temporarily. So therefore the devatas, the great sages, and the manus are included in this category of vibhuti. And the particular power given to the sages is distribute Vedic knowledge. The power given to the devatas is enforce the laws of karma and distribute, necessities to the living entities on Earth planet. And the power given to the manus is institute the system of dharma, varnashram, for the general public. So that is one of the topics of the Bhagavatam, to how the description of the manus and how they institute dharma. So this is a this whole karma yoga system of varnashram is a system for the people in general, not for the devotees particularly. That means that some people are qualified for bhakti and some are not. If they're not qualified for bhakti, at least they should do varnashram. If they don't even do varnashram, then they're considered hopeless. This is uncivilized people, the Chandalas and the Mlechas and others. Okay? So the first step in civilization is, for the human being is, follow this varnashram system. If they develop shraddha or faith, conviction in the supremacy of the one supreme Lord, and that we are the servant of that Lord, they are qualified for bhakti. So that's a higher qualification. General qualification of people is they simply want to survive in the material world. They want to get enough food for themselves and their family. People that are only interested in that, won't let them follow varnashram system. But this is considered superior to people who don't follow the system because there are specific rules to elevate you. Whereas in a non-varnashramic society with its rules and regulations, there is no real system for elevation as such. There's only provision for feeding you, that's all. So the basic financial, economic thing is taken care of, or they attempt to do so, but there's no goal of elevation because there's no concept of gunas even in these societies. But the scriptures point out we have tamagun, rajagun, sattvagun. So the goal is to raise a person from the lower guna to the higher guna. That's the goal in the varnashram system, from tamaguna to sattvaguna. And therefore we have classes based on gunas. We have sudras and tamagun. We have vaishyas and tamagun, rajagun. We have kshatriyas in rajagun, sattvagun. And we have brahmanas and sattvagun. So the whole purpose is elevation by restriction. Following certain rules and regulations help us elevate ourselves. So we start at the bottom. Minimum of rules and regulations, but something is there. That's for the sudras. By following those rules and regulations, gradually they elevate themselves into rajaguna. Then they become vaishyas. They're given a little more freedom. More rules to follow, though. Elevate themselves to rajaguna, sattvaguna, kshatriyas. Kshatriyas follow those rules properly. Gradually they elevate themselves after many, many births into brahminas, brahminical status, sattvaguna. So that's the whole idea of the varnashram system. Once one gets to sattvagun and one becomes very brahminical, one becomes qualified for jnana yoga and moksha. So in this system, therefore, artha, dharma, kama, and moksha are the goals. Moksha for jnana and artha, dharma, kama for the people in the sattvagun, rajagun, and tamagun. That's the limit of varnashram as such. And therefore, it is rejected as the system for the devotee. The devotee's goal is not artha, dharma, kama, moksha, but prema. Therefore, he has to follow a different system. So that is bhakti yoga. What's the difference? Bhakti yoga is not concerned with maintaining your material body, artha. It is not concerned with getting material enjoyment, kama. It is not concerned with the rules for getting these, dharma, nor is it concerned with getting impersonal liberation or moksha. Okay? So the means of getting to prema is simply activities like hearing, chanting, remembering, sadhu sangha, deity worship, etc. This is what we call bhakti. Okay? Now, the varnashram system may incorporate parts of bhakti, just as in bhakti, we can incorporate parts of varnashram, which are non-contrary. In a varnashram system, we can also put parts of bhakti. So we'll see.
in the Varnashram system. There's also worship of the Supreme Lord Vishnu or Krishna, along with worship of devatas, etc. There may be kirtan and so many other forms of worship also. Why we don't call it bhakti? We can call it bhakti, but it is bhakti maybe 1% or 2%. And its goal is quite different. Therefore, we don't call it bhakti, we call it varnashram. And in fact, that varnashram system does not really get its success in terms of peaceful maintenance of your material existence and elevation to svarga loka unless there is worship of the Supreme Lord in it. So some bhakti has to be there. In other words, it's not an independent system. It is dependent on bhakti. And even jnana, to get liberation, one has to also worship the Supreme Lord. So the goal of jnana, which is liberation, is also dependent on bhakti. Some of these systems are not really independent, though they look independent. And they have prominence of it. They must have worship of the Lord somewhere in them. But we do not call them bhakti because the majority of the system is something else and the goal is something else. Bhakti, on the other hand, does not depend on anything else to get its goal, prema. Varnashram cannot give prema. Jnana cannot give prema. Astanga yoga cannot give prema. Only bhakti can give prema. And whether we combine bhakti with jnana or karma or not, it gives the same result. It doesn't mean that it is better if we do bhakti and then we also do the varnashram system. Does it make it better? No. It may be favorable, but ultimately not necessary. So the only necessity to get prema is to do bhakti. Then, optionally, we may do parts of varnashram or parts of jnana, etc., as is favorable to us. Of course, we always find that the more a person advances, the less interested he is in anything else except bhakti. And therefore, we find a person like Madhavendra Puri that says, goodbye my tarpanas and goodbye my sanja vandana. These are all parts of varnashram system. They're goodbye all of this, goodbye all of that. I simply meditate on the Supreme Lord. That's all. So the more one becomes attracted to the Lord, the less interested one is in following these other duties. We see, though, very interestingly, that generally our acharyas do not explicitly reject the conduct of the varnashram system. So Lord Chaitanya himself followed the varnas and the ashramas. He conducted himself like a Brahmin in general and as a sannyasi in general. Again, we find he kind of contradicted it also in certain places. He took his food from low-class people who were Vaishnavas rather than from Brahmanas who were not Vaishnavas, for instance. So in this way, he contradicted the social system at the time. But in general, he followed some aspects of the Varnashram, despite of the fact that in so many places in Chaitanya Charitamrita, he condemns the Varnashram system as useless and external, etc. Yet, he still followed it. And we find acharyas like Vishwanath Chakravarti, who came from Brahminical, by birth families, they generally followed the system. They didn't break the system. And therefore, it is not that the system of bhakti is deliberately trying to reject or disturb the social system. But at the same time, it is pointing out the superiority and independence of bhakti over everything else. And therefore, everything else gets condemned in the process. That's why we find these condemnations of varnashram and jnana, etc. To show the superiority and independence of bhakti, and that it is quite different from any other system. So therefore, the question will then arise, even if Lord Chaitanya didn't reject the varnashram system in terms of his conduct, how should the devotees act in the modern age? Definitely in other ages, yes, they would follow to some degree, so our acharyas did follow, like Valadeva Jibhusan and Vishwanath Chakravarti followed. Others did not follow because they weren't in the system. Rupa and Sanatan were out of the system. They were rejected. Though they came from Brahminical families, originally from South India, they had associated with the Muslim government, and therefore they were rejected, so they couldn't even follow anything as far as Varnashram was concerned.
for that reason, they never even bothered to go in the Jagannath temple or try to go in the Jagannath temple because they were completely rejected as outcasts. So they also respected that system. They didn't challenge that social system at the time, in spite of the fact they're transcendental and they're highly qualified. So some of them were outside the system, some were in the system. Haridasa Thakura was outside the system also. He was completely beyond the whole system. And he never challenged it also. The others followed the system, and we'll see they respected, they didn't disturb the social system. And they followed certain rules and regulations, as if they were Brahmins, they would follow the Brahminical rules, etc., not just reject everything. So that was that carried on. But now we have the modern world where nobody really understands the system at all, really. And therefore, what is the respect for that system in the modern world? Even the Brahmanas tend not to follow much at all in the modern world, what to speak of other people in India. They're not even familiar with the rules and regulations of the Varnashram system anymore. The only remnants are attachment to worshipping devatas, which their families did for generations, which we're not interested in, or following samskaras. So they get a marriage, they have a marriage samskar, which is following the Varnashram system. So that's almost a minimum that people follow. Other than that, very few rules and regulations are followed by top to bottom, whether it's Sudra, Vaishya, Kshatriya, or Brahmana. Very few people follow in the modern world. The only place they would follow probably is in the temples in South India, for instance. The pujaris will follow because they're Brahmins. And in villages, they will follow to some degree some things. Other than that, very little is followed in the modern world. So then, what is the devotee approach to the Varnashram system? Do we follow or not? So in one sense, it's not very practical because most people struggle just to do the bhakti part, what to speak of doing anything else. Just to come up the standard of bhakti, they're struggling to do that. So how can they follow a whole other system of rules, which is actually foreign to them now because they don't even know anything about it? Especially if you're a foreigner. You're not even born in India. Then it is very foreign. So, to how much is it relevant? So that's the question we do have to ask. The main reason we do ask the question is because Prabhupada says, he emphasizes in some places the Varnashram system, that we should follow Varnashram, and that half my work is done, follow Varnashram. So then we get a little stuck in how to institute the Varnashram, which we can't even follow. And it's more difficult than following bhakti even. So that becomes a problem. How do we do that? So maybe the solution is simply that we take what is favorable in the Varnashram system that supports bhakti. In other words, we struggle to do bhakti, but maybe some things from the Varnashram will also help us to perform our bhakti properly. So those elements of regulations and purity and everything else that can help us execute hearing, chanting, remembering, and deity worship properly, yes, we can follow those to some extent, though not perfectly. So, of course, this is a far cry from varnas and ashramas, but it's taking some of the general rules that everybody in the varnashram system would follow and applying that to our code of conduct in terms of cleanliness, social interaction, etc., family, raising families, etc. And so that extent, good. Because the system of bhakti doesn't cover all the details of how to raise a family or how to interact with other people in society or how to keep your body clean or how to keep healthy or dietary regulations, etc. So that's found in other things like Ayurveda and the Varnashram system, etc. So, in that sense, we can follow aspects of Varnashram. Bhaktivinoda Thakur calls such rules that we borrow from the Varnashram to be secondary rules of bhakti. And the primary rules are things, activities which directly increase the bhakti, such as hearing,
chanting, remembering, deity worship. We have 64 angas in the nectar devotion. These directly produce or manifest and increase bhakti until we get prema. On the other hand, washing your body or brushing your teeth or dressing in clean clothes does not produce bhakti as such. Even people in the material world do these things, but they are regulated in a certain way in the Varnashram system, how to bathe, how to brush your teeth, how to put your clothes on. Some regulation is there. And this is favorable for our health, and for cleanliness is favorable to bhakti also. So therefore, they can be incorporated, but they don't produce bhakti. So we just realize that they are a different type of rule and regulation, that's all. And we borrow from the Varnashram system for those rules and regulations. Bhakti doesn't deal with how to support your body and all of this. So we take the favorable rules, which are non-contrary to bhakti, from that system and incorporate them in their life. Why? Because we are living in a society. If we do not live in a society and we're all off by ourselves alone somewhere, it doesn't matter. We don't have to follow. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to interact with people. You don't have to have a family. You don't have to keep clean. You can just sit in the cave all the time and chant Hare Krishna. And you can get perfection that way. But most people can't do that. They're living in a society with other people, with devotees and with family members, and they're maybe working at a job in the society, etc. So there has to be some interaction somewhere for most people. And therefore, let us follow these rules as much as possible, rules of the Varnashram system, where applicable to the individual. To that extent, we can follow what is favorable for our devotional development. Okay. Makes it into bhakti yoga.
There's
maybe two reasons for this. One, of course, is because there is an element of bhakti in karma yoga. That's the good element, but it's a minor element. So to distinguish them, then we have bhakti, which is only bhakti without any mixture at all. And then we have the karma yoga, which has some bhakti in it, but which is majority something else. And therefore, we'll find in the Karma Yoga section in Chapter 3, Krishna says, worship the devatas, and they give you all your desired results, and follow your duties, and do this and that, and be happy in this lifetime. So, obviously, it's not actually bhakti as we know it. But, because there is an element in bhakti also, we can say it like that. The other thing is that there's a way of interpretation, that's Baladeva Vidyabhusan's interpretation of Karma Yoga. He says, these are the activities described for a certain type of devotee who follows the Varnashram system, but is also doing bhakti. So he is doing the Karma Yoga as if it is part of his bhakti. He's not the supreme type of devotee, but he's a type of devotee. So he classifies devotees of three types. The first is one who is slightly attached to those Varnashram rules and follows everything very nicely, as if he's a Karma Yogi, but he's actually a devotee. He worships the Lord, etc. He has a slight attachment to following those rules and regulations. He's the lower level. Higher than that is another person who's doing the same devotional activities. He also follows the rules and regulations, but with no attachment. And the only reason he's doing them is to set an example for others. That's all. But he's still doing all the activities of Varnashram. So he's also a devotee, but he's still doing those rules also, as long as they're not contrary to bhakti. The third type of devotee is one who has no interest in doing them at all. He is simply attached to the Supreme Lord, and he rejects everything. He doesn't follow any rules at all. He just says, bhakti, finished. So the last two are basically the same, except one is following simply because he wants to set an example for others. So we find the example of kings like Dhruva or Ambarish or Prahlad, etc. They actually don't have any attachment to those rules at all. They just want to do bhakti. But they set an example as leaders of society, as kings for the other people. And other people are maybe a little more attached to those rules and regulations they follow. So they're doing the Karma Yoga and they're doing the bhakti. So
So in one sense, you can say everything is bhakti because it's, they're devotees, so everything is bhakti. But those karma yoga rules are maybe like what we call secondary rules. And in the Bhakti Sandarbha, Jiva Goswami says, such things as karma yoga, when they are simultaneously done with bhakti, can be called sangha siddha bhakti. They become bhakti by association with bhakti. Even though technically they're not bhakti by their very nature, but when they're combined with the bhakti and they help out the bhakti, okay, we can call it part of bhakti also. So in that sense, karma yoga can become bhakti also, where it's used to support the bhakti. Or where it's done independently, then it's considered useless completely. And if you reject the worship of the bhakti completely, it's also considered useless. Yeah. So obviously, atheists also bathe. Impersonalists also bathe, and they maybe follow the Vedic rituals for bathing, etc. Especially the Mayavadis, but they never get bhakti because they bathe. Even being a vegetarian does not necessarily make you into a devotee. Huh? And so all the impersonalists are also generally Shankarites, etc. Are vegetarian, huh? But simply not eating meat does not make you produce bhakti either. What they do is they purify you to a certain extent and put you up to sattva gun. Yeah? But they don't in any way cause bhakti or create bhakti or manifest bhakti or make bhakti grow as such. But along with bhakti, they can be favorable for us. Yeah? So in that sense, cleanliness is also one of those things which is sattvic by nature and therefore favorable for our devotional development. But it's also distinct from bhakti itself. And so.
Nishkam karma yoga, does it come into sattva or is it beyond?
Yeah, that's the sattvic aspect of karma yoga. When we are in Raja and Tamagun, generally it's sakama karma yoga. And when we get to, let's say, the top of Raja Guha and we get into sattva, then it becomes nishkama karma yoga. Yeah.
But in
in itself, Nishkama Karma Yoga cannot give liberation because we do need the cultivation of the understanding we're not the body, we are the Atma, everything like that, which is part of Jnana Yoga. So therefore, the Nishkama Karma Yoga generally combines with the Jnana Yoga, and then we can get our liberation. The two are, we can say, compatible. Obviously, Sakama Karma Yoga and Jnana cannot go along because qualification for Jnana Yoga is Sattva. And Sakama Karma Yoga is in Rajagun, Tamagun. So that doesn't work at all. So when we come to Nishkama Karma Yoga, then that is quite the one that leads into Jnana Yoga quite conveniently. And the two can be practiced simultaneously.
So the
it would have to be some mixture, yeah. I think in the is it the teachings of Kapila? There he mentions the different goals you get from the different processes, etc. Generally, karma yoga can lead you upwards, and probably you can go to Brahmaloka or something ultimately with Nishkama Karma Yoga. And that to get out of the material world, you have to do something, mix it with the jnana, at least.
In pure devotion, service, one has to be in mode of goodness always?
Pure devotional service? No. Pure devotional service is beyond the mode of goodness. It is visuddha sattva. If we get stuck in sattva gun, that will lead us to liberation. Jnana is in sattva gun. That will lead to liberation. but not to bhakti. So bhakti goes beyond the gunas. It is nirguna. Its nature is nirguna. It is beyond the gunas. Vishuddha sattva.
Also, it is said that Maitreya Muni was a mixed devotee before and later on after giving instruction to Vidura, he became a pure devotee. Is it true?
I've never seen a comment like that. It's possible. Definitely his status was actually not, we can say, as advanced as Vidura, because Vidura was actually an associate of the Lord. So he was a very high status, but in spite of that fact, Vidura was taking instructions from Maitreya.
Maharaj, you mentioned that the Manus are the one who actually institute Varnashram Dharma.
What's that?
The Manus?
Yeah.
They institute Varnashram Dharma.
Mm.
So, do they do directly or?
Their descendants also.
Descendants, okay, so that's why the fifth canto, fine woman who is getting King Priyavrata.
Yeah. So one of the we see in the Bhagavatam, it traces the lineage from Swayambhu, Humana, Priyavrata, Dhruva, all these kings, da 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 da. And then when we get to the ninth canto, it traces them all the way up to Krishna. There's different descendants from Manu going all the sub-branches and everything, and then we get up to Krishna. And then after that, there's a whole discussion of how the branches die out, etc. And then the demons take control, and they assassinate somebody, and the dynasties are completely useless in Kali Yuga because there's no descendant of Manu left. And the only one left is hiding in the Himalayas someplace, and he won't manifest himself until the next Satya Yuga. So that we're real hopeless in Kali Yuga. Yeah, well, that's the question I was posing here, to what extent we can do it. And it looks as if we can do very little as far as the Varnashram proper. Because as Prabhupada mentions in the purport, right out, we reject the Varna by birth. And a lot of the system, as we know it, is based upon the birth. For instance, the family system, the occupation, everything is based upon that. Huh? In other words, you're born in a family, a goldsmith, you become a goldsmith. And so it's no question of going to university or whatever like this. You just get trained up by your parents. If you're a potter's family, you become a potter, and you don't go to college to learn pottery. You learn from your parents. So you don't have to go to all these different endeavors to find out who you are and what you're going to do. It's just a taken for granted by your birth of what you're going to be. So that's by birth. So if we don't do by birth, then we do have a big problem. And it introduces a whole other system of education, etc., because everybody has to figure out what varna they're in, whatever, after they're grown up. And so it's quite different system from what we see as a normal system in the Varnashram when we introduce the not by birth. But so then what do? And then we have to make some endeavor to have establish a whole educational system and a whole judging system for people, etc., which is very complicated, you know, which probably people won't even want to do anyway. So these are some of the problems that come up in the institute. The other is we don't even have a system with a king anymore because the Manu's descendant is hiding in the Himalayas. So how do we institute such a system as such? You know, it's impossible also. Because without that authority of the king, again, it doesn't work. And how we do it in the modern world where we have democracy, unless you create a revolution and overthrow all the governments. You know, there's a lot of problems in instituting Varnashram as such. So my solution is that we just take some aspects of the Varnashram that are favorable for bhakti and we try to implement those, that's all. They may be minor things, but that's all we can do at the present time.